You are now listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast, where the worlds of sports medicine and performance collide. My name is Mike Quintons. I'm a physical therapist with an entrepreneurial mindset that specializes in treating orthopedic and sports injuries. I'm bringing on the brightest and sharpest in the field of sports medicine to share their best practices and explore the gap where medicine meets performance. What's up, Performance Therapy Nation? This is your host of the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast, Mike Quintons. Today, we are joined by Mike Wilson. Mike earned his Master's of Science degree from Ithaca College in 2003, where he played intercollegiate basketball. He earned his doctorate in physical therapy at Temple University in 2008. Mike has been full body certified in active release technique, or ART, since 2005 and obtained his orthopedic clinical specialist certification in 2009. Additionally, he has certifications that include functional movement screening, or FMS, selective functional movement assessment, SFMA, Postural Restoration Institute, PRI, and functional range conditioning, FRC. In addition to patient care, Mike is a regional clinical director at Premier Orthopedics and participates as an adjunct faculty member at Widener University DPT program. All right, Mike, thank you for joining us today. How you doing today, man?
I'm good, man. I'm excited to be here.
Good. Awesome. And I'm with Rob Rubina here, our strength conditioning coach at Ivy Rehab. How you holding up, Rob?
Good. Doing great.
So let's dive into some low back pain. So what percentage of people across the United States experience back pain at some point in their lives? Do you know the number, answer to that?
I don't know. It's got to be like 100.
It's like 70%. 70-80% of every U.S. like person in the United States will experience low back pain at some point, right? So this is definitely applicable to our listeners, and obviously we see it every day in the clinic. So what are your philosophies in treating low back pain, specifically with radiculopathy or sciatica?
Yeah, there's so much to unpack when it comes to back pain. Yeah. And I think, like, as my career has progressed, it seems to become more and more the percentage of my patients becomes 100% low back pain. Maybe that's why it skewed my answer.
Yep.
I think the first thing is I'm always digging in to try and figure out what's going on in their life at the time that the back pain started. And I think we're going to get deeper into the pain science part later, but yep, almost without fail, there's some change that happened around the onset of the low back pain. So I kind of bring that to their attention. I ask lots of leading questions to try and kind of unpack what could be going on. And then we de-escalate from there and just start working on breathing patterns and calming their bodies down. Until that point, they're not really, I don't think, susceptible to change or to have a change of mindset. I think a lot of people just start to associate themselves with that low back pain, and just, you know, if they don't have it now, they expect it to come next week. And no matter what they do, it's inevitable. And just starting to work on the mental aspect of that so they, you know, can get over it and start to believe that there's possibility that they're going to get over it.
Sure. And how do you manage that at the first visit? Because obviously, you know, the first visit influences the rest of the care, right? So how do you manage that at the first visit when a patient's walking and they're like, all right, fix me?
Yeah, I'm very slow with the subjective. I learned this from a class I took once, that you ask hard questions and then you wait, and you don't necessarily let them get out of it. You just sit there on it for a little bit. And you know, there's always something. And it's amazing that since I've really gotten into this, I have had more people cry in like emotional outlet sort of ways in their first visit than I've had in the rest of my career. And from there, you all of a sudden have this amazing bond with the people. And then everything else from there is downhill. So I really think there's so much value in that. And obviously not every egg cracks on the first visit, but more often than not, if you kind of give them the time and you listen, I think it works out. So that's the non-PT answer. That's right. Like my psych answer.
Well, listen, I think that says plenty, right? Like that's where you're going to open up that answer with, right? Or, you know, with that question, that response, that's super relevant.
So to move PT on. Answer. Yeah. So I'm an accumulation of a lot of continuing ed. So I think something that stuck with me throughout everything is the top tier SFMA screen. I think it's a really easy way to get people moving before you start breaking down and looking at impairments. I'm definitely not the impairment based guy. I'm definitely a functional movement guy first. And I'm looking at motor control and mobility from the very beginning, movement quality. And I just want to see like the big broad strokes, what they can do with their bodies. From there, I do break it down when needed in terms of like mobility or hypermobility in different directions, facet restrictions, things of those nature. But I spend more of the time on cleaning up movement quality and educating on like non-back dominant patterns, I guess, from the outset. And that kind of brings me back to breathing a little bit too, because I think so many people, inhale in a way that utilize their back extensors, and those back extensors become hard and long and glute-like. And until you learn how to exhale, you're not ever going to get out of back pain. And nevertheless, you're never going to learn how to squat, lift, or press anything without exacerbating your back pain. So I teach that first to almost anybody that walks in the door, because once they're under load, I have to be able to say exhale or sigh or do something and take the tension off of the back extensors.
I love that. I feel like my background is so mechanical. So the transition to some of those ideas, concepts, for me at least, has been challenging. But once you see it work, you're like, wait, I didn't have to like grade 5 mobilization or manip to like help them feel better. So, and I remember when I was at Widener, you were a professor, adjunct professor there. I knew you as a guy who knew his manual therapy techniques long, had good leverage. And so you go from teaching us these techniques when I was in school, and now you're bringing like a little bit of a different approach clinically. What are some of the reasons for that, or your thoughts behind that?
Yeah, so I was fortunate enough really early in my career to have an opportunity to certify an active release technique, which gives you a lot of hands-on experience and a lot of fine-tuning your touch. I know Matt Costa in a previous episode referenced the hair between the pages of the book. And I learned this from another great doctor that I used to work with. And I used to do it all the time. And people didn't believe that you could do it. And then you do it. And so you start to develop that. But ART also taught you how to identify tissues, name it, move it, and be really good with your anatomy. So from there, going back and kind of educating the next generation of manual therapists, I think I put a little bit more priority on knowing what they're doing and feeling as opposed to the technique. And I'm also a big picture, not a follow the directions, like step-by-step kind of guy. And you see these students like trying to regurgitate 17 pages in a textbook, and they don't have a clue what they're trying to do. They're just like trying to do like this step, then this step. So I took a step back for them and like forced them to tell me why they were doing it. And I think one of the most easy examples was the concept of flexibility versus mobility. And it's as simple as you either make the muscle get in the way or you get the muscle out of the way to see which one's stopping the joint. And nobody had a clue what the difference was. And they were just, and once you know that, it's very obvious which is which. So yeah, I think I tried to bring the bigger picture and still follow the rules and make sure they're going to pass the test, because that's all they care about.
Yeah, right. And that's what matters. Now, in terms of getting pain to centralize, how do you go about that? Is that important to you when someone is performing a movement in terms of those McKenzie principles, which are, just to review very briefly, you want the pain to centralize, right? To go back towards the spine, the segment in which the nerve is coming from, right? Or the nerve compression is coming from. So if it peripheralizes, goes further down the leg, then that's considered to be a position or movement you would like to avoid, as opposed to going the opposite direction, which would hopefully then centralize, right? That's a philosophy. We always want it to centralize. So how much do you take that into consideration with your big picture perspective?
I think I pull that out a very small percentage at a time, but for the right people, I definitely do. McKenzie is, I think research backs it up as being a really effective acute and early stage treatment modality. I don't know that I see a lot of people at that phase. And as a result, I don't find it that necessary. But if I just can't get somebody to calm down and I can't get the pain to centralize, then I will definitely try some press ups or whichever the mobility direction is that centralizes it. But it tends to be more, in my experience, like you can take that away once you can get them to move in a way that's not overutilizing the one pattern that put them there in the first place.
Right.
And then I apply ART at that point. Like there's a lot of long tension nerve things. There's you're looking for entrapment sites at major muscle groups. And as you start to get the nerves to move through the structures a little bit more, you also get centralization that way too. So I tend to fall back to that type of manual therapy as opposed to just movement based.
So more focus on soft tissue mobility than joint mobility and the less chronic patient population?
I would say. I mean, joint mobility certainly and very important. I do more basic mobilization with movement, Mulligan style, or even just general mobilizations if they need to unlock a little bit. But I'm very careful. Early in my career too, I got really into manual therapy and I was good at it and patients loved it too much. And as I learned pain science and I get into it deeper and deeper, I try and touch people less a little bit because I know that that's too convincing and they then like associate me with their only chance at recovery. So as soon as I can, I get away, try and teach them things that they can do for themselves. That's definitely been an evolution.
I love that. And that's, you know, one of the questions that we had. And Rob, please chime in on this.
Oh, this is great. You guys keep going.
Yeah. How's your philosophy progressed was my initial question, which you kind of hit a little bit more manual therapy and then geared toward hands off. Are there any other ways, whether it's maybe breathing or exercises or an initial approach, what areas you're going to target first in terms of how your approach has changed through the years?
So yeah, it's wholly different for sure. It used to be very PT-like. like what you learn in school and what you do, and you go through the steps and the exam takes a really long time and you hit everything. And now it's obviously become a lot more breathing. I've gotten a lot more involved in like heavy loading of patients. I love the theory that weakness is way more dangerous than an injured knee or back.
I love that.
Yeah. You look at longevity studies in seniors, and they don't die because their knees hurt. They die because they can't carry their bodies around anymore.
Yeah.
So whenever somebody gives me back over a lift, that's the easy answer. So I deadlift ladder a lot with people that shouldn't be lifting a lot of weight, or at least don't think they should be lifting a lot of weight. I'm really careful about the words I choose. I know the concept of like the nocebo, but people hear the words from the doctor's office and then it changes the way they move for the rest of their lives. Like a great example is I had a 90-year-old woman who stopped bending over at the age of 20 because she was told she had a herniated disc, and if she bends, it will make it worse. And so you can imagine like her brain's picturing this like forward bend with like an explosion out her back breaking the window behind her.
It's crazy.
So she never did it. And I had her bend over and it bent and it worked. And she was like, man, all those years.
They're a saint. Canonize them.
So people just like, I think medical people and the words we use are so important.
Yes.
That it really can change the experience for people.
Positively or negatively, yeah, even,
for,
right?
For sure. Yeah. Right. And you name a problem, you all of a sudden have that problem, whether that's the source of their pain or not.
Like, do patients look at you crazy when you're telling them to lift weights? It's going to help their pain?
At times. I have a number of that, yeah.
Now, how do you...
I found lots of ways around it, but yeah.
So how do you like tell them like, hey, like we're going to do more weight on this. It's going to help your... you know, whatever, low back pain.
So I use the, you got to be stronger than you are heavy thing all the time. And once you turn 50, much harder to put on muscle. If you don't get ahead of it by then you're in trouble. And I use a lot of like, I guess my most recent thing. So pain science has been one big push for me. Breathing has like changed my world. That's like a wholeheartedly kind of my main focus. But strength and conditioning and understanding the reps, rests, sets, exercise style, speed, loads, and applying that to like patient population. Right. Also a really nice change.
Right, because I tell people to lift more weights all the time. It's for performance, or it's for fitness, or it's for health. So I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, that you're doing great stuff.
Thanks. And carries, farmer's carries. Like people never know what good posture is. And I give them 250-pound kettlebells and have them stand there. They might barely be able to grip them. But by the time I take them away from them, they know how to stand up straight. So load answers a lot of the problem.
How good is good enough for someone with low back pain?
In terms of technique?
In terms of like being done with physical therapy, or like completing a physical therapy. And I know that's a relative question, but yeah. I'm expecting a relative answer out of it as well. But like, I feel like I hear that all the time, or even some PTs ask like, they still have a little bit of low back pain, but everything's centralized. Functionally, they can do most things and they're pretty good with their exercises. So their outcome measure was 75 out of 100.
Mm.
You know, is that good enough?
Yeah, good enough for me is if the goal that they wanted to get to, they feel like they can achieve it on their own at that point. So they don't always get there when they're with me, but they know they can and they know they're safe at that point. More often than not, people are trying to hang in there because they know I can progress them a lot farther than they're willing to progress themselves. So even though they know they're on the right track, they're like, wait, I want to see what he's got next. And I'm doing pull-ups with everybody. Like, you know, I don't care if you can't yourself.
Yeah.
Put a band on, I help them out. The day like some older woman does a pull-up for the first time in her life, she's like, you know, on a high for the next two or three visits. It's awesome.
Love it, man. Let's dive into low back pain in athletic populations. So what's your experience with spondies, and in what population do you tend to see them the most?
So my hours don't really give me a lot of young athletes lately. I will say like gymnasts, track athletes, and I don't know, baton twirlers, as ridiculous as that sounds, I've had a lot of them.
Actually, that's never treated a baton twirler, but it mechanically makes sense.
It's like
the amount of extension you have to do with a leg up in the air sometimes, right? Yeah,
it's that and like classic movement. That and labral tears in the hip. That's like the challenge. Yeah.
How about it?
I think I know two of them, and both of them got full scholarships to like an SEC school. Yeah.
That's great.
That is an underutilized scholarship, apparently.
So in terms of managing them, sometimes they're brave, sometimes they're not. I feel like it's different docs of different philosophies. I think it's starting to become a little more generalized now. Is there any specific approach that you would take differently with that population compared to somebody else?
Aside from like really being careful that they're not forcefully extending. I think that's the caveat with anything. I think with most, this is, I hesitate to say it this way because it sounds possibly cookie cutter, but I've boiled my treatments down to a very baseline level where I need people to be able to lift, carry, push, pull, squat, pull up, stuff like that, right? So I need that person to do that, just like I need the person with the herniated disc and the ACL repair and the ankle sprain and everybody else. So generally, people are doing different exercises It just depends on where they're slotting in their rehab experience or life. And so if you need the motor control, if you need the flexibility, if you need whatever you need to get to the point that where you can do those confidently and safe and like feel like you can push it, then that's kind of how I treat it. So each injury's got its own things where I have to be careful because you got to respect the anatomy and the healing process. But when it comes down to it, like spondies, I don't do like a flexion-based program because I don't want them to extend and work on this, this, and this. It's just like, I want you to deadlift and you can't because you can't control your hamstrings at 90 degrees. So let's start there.
I love that. That's a strength conditioning approach.
It's training,
It's training. I mean, so, you know, I think it's great for all the young PTs out there to hear this, and maybe I'm way off the mark on it, but at what point in your PT career did you implement that approach with the different movements?
Yeah, it's been gradual. I learned it with the FMS, and I took, so Brett Jones and Greg Cook did a combo class once upon a time that was kettlebell. It was strong first kettlebell with the FMS, and it was great because you got to see how each tier of the FMS like translated to red, green light, and yellow light activities, and then you started to figure out how to implement right away. So kettlebell kind of got me into it. I've always been into strength and conditioning, and I played college basketball and lifted. I'm used to that. I got kind of really into it through CrossFit, just through personal exploration, because I had never done Olympic lifting myself. And everything I do for myself, I kind of, you know, I experiment on me, and then I always apply it to patients. There's always the right patient walking in the door that's like, oh, that guy can do this. So, that's how it's grown. I just feel like there's a chronic underloading problem in our profession. And you have to be aware enough of certain parameters, and you have to be able to read the patient well enough to not injure them. And I think that's the hard thing to translate to new therapists, is that you can't just say you all underload people, because there's so much nuance to figuring out if you're actually hurting them. And I get why a new grad gun shy, too much load too soon. At the same time, otherwise tissue doesn't respond.
Right. And that the least we can do is cause no harm, right? In PT at least, right? So we have to make sure we're not doing that, but got to load the tissue, right? I agree with you. My philosophy has changed too, where we need to load more.
You can argue that not loading enough is doing more harm.
Yeah, right. I mean, attention too, let's be honest. Like PT is headed towards, is already in some, you know, environments, a volume-based world, right? And you're a regional, you know, manager, I'm an area manager. Like I know that volume is, you know, important to an extent, and there's certain parameters that we got to hit, but we got to be able to do a good job doing them, right, while we're doing them. So
yeah, got to keep the doors open.
You got to
make money. Yeah,
absolutely, right.
But do right by your patients.
But with that, in my opinion, drives me nuts when I see a PT with three patients or whatever, however many they have, and they're typing the whole time. Like who's paying attention to them? Are one aide watching all three of them? Again, comes with experience reading the patient, et cetera. It's someone who's been through it a lot and has done that exercise previously. They've done it with good form.
Yeah,
it's all good. But
let me, I would add to that something that I've kind of gotten into a little bit more recently is I don't think that we give patients enough time to explore the exercise either. Like you got a PT sitting on you, making sure you're doing everything right.
Right.
Pelvic tilt, lean this way, tighten this thing, right? And then the patient doesn't get confident that they can do it themselves, for one. And for two, like you do all that, you do their 10 reps, you've kind of like held their hands through the whole thing, and they've never really felt it. They've never made mistakes. You never gave them a chance to fail. So almost every exercise, give them cues for a minute or so, like say, can you feel it? The goal is to not think about the words. It's to feel that feeling. Yeah. And then walk away and be like, listen, I want you to spend some time with this, wrap your head around it. I'll come back and then let's talk it through again. So I think new grads that feel like they have to always be on the patient and can't get their documentation done, there's a way to do both and really do right for both of you. Yeah.
That's an art in of itself, in what I've seen at least. So I agree with that. Anything else you want to add?
No, I mean, I agree. And that's pretty much what I do. I mean, you've seen that happen firsthand. Like I'm not against like one-on-one like treating or training, but I do feel like there's a benefit in, you know, having your client learn themselves in some degree and not over coaching or over cueing them with all these cues that you learned on this weekend course or in school. People don't respond to that well. They don't move well. They don't learn that way. So, you know, giving a cue here and there, stepping back, letting them figure it out. And then that builds onus on them to, like, you know, learn the exercise name, learn the exercise technique themselves, so that when you're not there one day, they can do it.
I love it. That's all I got. Anything else to add?
No, that's good stuff.
All right.
Good.
Well, that's a wrap for this episode. Stay tuned for two more episodes with Doctorate of Physical Therapy Mike Wilson. In the next episode, Mike defines pain science and how he implements it in his practice. We will also discuss PRI, Postural Restoration Institute, and how both Mike and I apply these concepts in our respective crafts.
Thanks for listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast. If you'd like this episode, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It would mean so much to me if you could leave us a 5-star review so more listeners like you could get this important information. See you next time.